leading it, or whoever is leading it, and all of a sudden, Mike comes up onto the platform, and he comes and tells me something. Well, that something was, Dad, I have an emergency. So I didn't know about that, so I walk off the platform, and I get about halfway down this aisle, and probably some of you older folks were starting to laugh at me, taking my son to the bathroom. But I got you back. What you didn't know is I needed to go so bad I could hardly even think about preaching. But anyway, our times here at South Mountain have been real, real dear to us, and we want to just thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your part in our ministry. And you know what? It's about prayer more than anything else. And as the older we get, and the more we see of God's history in our lives, and we see God's moving in people's lives that we thought were impossible, villages in Alaska that were impossible, now have the gospel, and there are believers there loving the Lord, and even in the one village are sending people out to other villages to honor God, and you see that in time. So we just want to thank you for all that you've done for us over the years. And today what I'd like to do is turn to Ezekiel chapter 8. And as you're turning, I want to talk a little bit about having devotions. The pastor's wife, I think, is in the midst of what I'm trying to get over. So this morning here, I was really sick a week ago. I'm doing fairly well now, but pray for me if my voice stays good here for the next few moments. Anyway, I always struggled in school. I went to West Virginia University. I struggled there. I struggled at Bible college. I would just go to a class and just get interested in the subject, and the bell would ring. And then I'd have to pack up my books and go to another class and just settle down in my thinking in that class, and then the bell would ring. And that's the way it was for me. And I just struggle with that. I found out that my learning pattern, over the years, I figured the thing out. And what I like to do is do one subject, do it all at once, and do it well, and forget everything else. And that's my learning pattern. And that's the way I come to the Scripture. My wife is the opposite. She is the epitome of faithfulness. With her daily bread, her prayer list, her Bible, and all the stuff that she does every morning, not necessarily just a certain hour, but almost a certain hour. And I look at that, and I just shake my head. And so, anyway, here's the way I do devotions. I sit down, and I can't do it quite as well as I used to, but I read a whole book of the Bible in one sitting. Like some of these hard ones, like Ezekiel. Now, I'm a little slow now, but I used to be able to speed all the way through a book. I might do that on a Monday morning for an hour or so, whatever it takes me to do it. And then, I hate to confess this, but I might not open my Bible for 3 or 4 days. And that sounds like heresy. But what I'm doing is I am thinking through that book of Ezekiel and all my spare time from Monday to whatever date I pick it back up again. And I'm trying to figure out in my mind, why did God say what he said, I say in this book? What were the people like? What were they doing? Why were they doing it? What's the outcome in that day? Then I think of the culture I'm in, the Blackfoot culture. How does this stuff apply? Is it something that's up to date, or is it just old history that's gone by, like a book of Ezekiel written a long time ago? Does it apply? If it does, how does it apply? If it does, how do I make it apply so that my Blackfoot people would understand? And then, obviously, there's me. What does these scriptures mean to me now? Today, what do I need to alter in my life? What do I need to change? How do I need to guide my family, my children and spouses and grandchildren, the people that I influence in the community? How does this book relate to that? That's in my mind going all the time. And I can't memorize scripture. I've worked on that for years, and I struggle like mad to do that. The only thing that I can memorize is you put me in a small airplane, and I can memorize the terrain. So in the north, when we were flying, the pilots would be playing around with all of their maps, and I'd say, forget them. I know where we're at. But I struggle with that over the years. But, you know, I can think through passage volumes of Scripture and know where I'm at and why. And that's just my learning pattern. So a few months ago, I'm sitting down, and I'm reading the book of Ezekiel. And I get to chapter 8, and as I'm reading it, I'm saying, wow, this was in the Old Testament? This sure looks like it's Blackfoot country. And so this morning, I want to talk to you a little bit about the book of Ezekiel. And we'll look at three different occasions in this chapter and this vision that Ezekiel has. And then I want to share with you how that relates to Blackfoot country. And then I'm not going to say a whole lot how that relates to us here. I will conclude with one area. I'll leave that up to your pastor to do. But what my intent this morning is to show you what the people in Blackfoot country are like. And we're talking not of believers here. We're talking of the general population this morning that's unsaved and not honoring God. We talked in our in our Sunday school time about those that are honoring God and moving on for Him. So this morning, I want to share more about the general culture and some of the characteristics that they have in order that you might effectively pray for us as we combat those issues in the Blackfoot people's lives in order to present Christ to them. So that's their intent. So let's get busy in the book. In chapter 8, Ezekiel's in exile, and he's meeting with the elders of Judah. In verse 1 there, it says, while I was sitting in my house, and the elders of Judah were sitting before me, the hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me. I looked and I saw a figure like that of a man from what appeared to be his waist down. He was like fire, and there up his appearance was as bright as glowing metal. He stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head. I don't know if that angel there could do that to me, but Ezekiel apparently had enough hair. Anyway, it says, the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and in visions of God, He took me to Jerusalem, to the entrance to the north gate of the inner court, where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. And there before me was the glory of the God of Israel, and in the vision I had seen in the plain. Then He said to me, Son of man, look towards the north. So I looked, and in the entrance north of the gate of the altar, I saw the idol of jealousy. And He said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The other detestable things the house of Israel is doing here. Things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. But you will see things that are even more detestable. And then He brings Ezekiel through the temple area, and he gives him three pictures of what's happening there in this vision. And that's what we want to look at this morning. As you look at the temple or the tabernacle, and I remember when I was first in a Bible-believing church at age 14, and the people there had been schooled in the Bible, and here I'm a teenager that's been in a liberal church all my life, and I don't know what in the world's going on. And I hear about all this furniture and this and that and the other and the temple and the tabernacle and all that. And I'm thinking, wow, this is all complicated. And then I began reading it and growing in the Lord, went on to Bible college and so forth. And now I look back and I see it is not complicated. There's only 7 pieces of furniture in the temple, the tabernacle within the temple. And a man who wanted to honor God in his life would realize from the reading of the Old Testament law, where it's very plain, if he offended God, he then would bring the appropriate sacrifice to the court, the opening there and the gate. And at that point, that would be an innocent animal, had no idea what he was doing there, anything, or a bird, depending on the wealth of the man or the type of sacrifice to be offered. And he would yield up, he would tell the priest why he's there, and he would yield up that innocent animal, and from there on, it was all out of his hands. He, by faith, would come and deal with his sin and ask the priest then to do all the ceremony with that particular animal that he was to do. It was an issue of sin. It was an issue of a broken relationship with the living and true God. That was that issue. And that's it. And I know there's all types of ceremonies there, and you read, you see there's reason for many of those things. There's the Day of Atonement. There's the covering of the sin. And the whole thing is a picture, as we know, of the coming of Jesus Christ to be here on this earth as God-man, to then offer his life on the cross for our sin. And that Old Testament is a picture. And as those people by faith walk through those ceremonies, that's what they understood, that there would be the coming Messiah that would fulfill all of those ceremonies. It all had to do with a broken relationship with God. And that's it. When you go back to Genesis, and in the first 3 chapters, and you get to the place where Adam and Eve are walking in the garden, and they take a look at the tree that they weren't supposed to be a part of, and they partake of that. And then God comes back in that evening, and he wants to walk and talk with them. He created Adam and Eve above the animal world and all the rest of creation, the highest form of creation, which is the opposite of what the Blackfoot think. And he made them so they could communicate with him. And he came down desiring to have a time of fellowship in the cool of the evening. And what happened to Adam and Eve when they sinned? They found out that their bodies needed a little clothing and their shame. And they went and tried to patch themselves up with a bunch of leaves. Some of this is hilarious to me, but I'm used to dealing with people that think in those areas in the native culture, seeing people trying to sew those things together and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, they did. And then when God come down, they hid because they had broken the relationship between themselves and God. And what did God do in that chapter? He sets in motion ceremonies that they are to do to heal that relationship. And that's what the tabernacle and the temple is all about. The healing of a broken relationship between sinful man and sinless God. And God desires as many as will come by faith to bring the appropriate sacrifice of the Old Testament. And then from the time it's given to the priest, they release it by faith, knowing that it would be taken care of. And now in the New Testament, we come to the empty cross in memory of what Christ has done. And God mends that relationship with us, and we now become children of God. That's what the Bible is all about, the healing of a broken relationship. And in our native people's way of thinking, that is a huge issue to them. Relationships are a huge issue. And they understand when we're talking this way to them about what that means. So anyway, now here we got the temple. It's been messed up because of the destruction the Babylonians did to it and so forth. And there's some activity going on. And somebody is going through the motions of doing what I just talked about. But it's going through the motions in all probability. Very little of any true faith here because of the next few verses. So then, excuse me, and then in verse 9, he says to me, rather verse 8, then he brought me to the entrance to the court, and I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. And he said to me, son of man, now dig into the wall. So I dug into the wall and I saw a doorway there. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked and detestable things they are doing there. So I went in and looked and saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel, and Jezreniah, son of Shaphan, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. And you look at that, and here you've got the elders of Israel that are in God's house. They should have been, by faith, performing the simple ceremonies of the temple. But what were they doing? They had a secret compartment and the holes in the wall, and Ezekiel digs through the hole, and then there's a secret door. And when they get in there, here's all these men, and they're offering incense. That is a big thing in a lot of cultures. And there's all kinds of concoctions of incense that's out there. And one time, I was with a man, a Japanese man who had never been in a Catholic funeral. And he was quite outspoken. And so as the coffin was going down the aisle to the front, and the priest was coming behind waving the little incense thing that was smoking, all of a sudden June got a whiff of that. And he says out real loud, that stinks. And I'm about ready to crawl into the pew because I'm the only white guy and there's about 300 Indian people. And he's the only Japanese guy. But literally what's happening here, each of these men that are in there have some type of incense concoction that has been transferred down from that false god system that they're worshiping. These are multiple false god systems in there. Each one has kind of their own. And so they're worshiping. And that stuff that's on the wall, we don't know. It just says it's detestable things. Well, if we go back to the Old Testament law, the detestable animals that the Israeli people were not to eat, the ones they were not to eat, they probably had a pig up there. And then when you look at the art of the ancient world and in the false god systems, they probably had that place blasted with pornography and the way that they would worship that. You read the old god systems, you see a lot of that in there. What was there, I don't know fully, but I'm just suggesting that those type of things were there because that would have been a part. If we knew the name of the god they were worshiping, then we could paint up there what represented that god. And here these guys were doing that. And literally, when you think of the tabernacle system and we think of a man bringing an offering to the court at the entrance there, an offering up by faith, and then God takes it through the hands of the priest and the procedures are done and his sin is covered. The relationship is restored. What's happening in this room is 70 different guys with 70 different concoctions in all probability, because it talks about each their own. And that's a significant idea in this passage. And all you end up with is 70 different guys stinking. Nothing changes in their hearts. It is a dead ceremony to a dead god. And they just smell. The with the aroma of whatever they're offering. And if it's a bunch of men mixing up, it might be a real mess. Anyway, what do the Blackfoot people do? The Blackfoot people, as the government and the universities are pushing them and telling them to stand up and bring back your old ways, they are smudging every time something turns around. And the smudge is it's a piece of sweet grass about that long. There's three strands that are braided together to make it like a rope. And this particular type of grass does not flame. When you light it, it smokes. And so what happens now in Blackfoot Country, whenever there is a gathering of the people for whatever reason, it could be a PTA meeting where they're thinking about putting up a gym set on the playground, or it could be a demonic sweat or ceremony. All those variations in between. They come and they sit roughly in a circle. There is a leader who lights the sweet grass, and then he goes to each person, stands in front of them as they're seated, and then they take the smoke like this and washes themselves ceremonially with that smoke. And then he passes it on to another person. And that's to bring them in communication with the spirits that they are thinking about or worshiping at that point for a spirit of unity to have a good meeting. But I know Blackfoot people, and especially Blackfoot old ladies. And they are extremely opinionated. And you think a little bit of smoke is going to change that? That just gets their dandruff up. And so if you're painting a room and you go to Lady A and she wants it green, she'll have it green over your dead body. And that smoke's not going to change a thing. And in the men, the same way. Those ceremonies are dead and useless, but these people practice them as if they're alive and well and they are doing something in their lives. But they're not changing a thing on the inside at all. It's just like what happened in that temple with those men who were in their secret compartment worshiping their way, their God, while they should have been doing something by faith for the true and living God in that building. They weren't doing it. So that's the first thing. But our Blackfoot people today are smudging, and if you get around them, they and you get become a part of any of their sweats, that's a part of that. Now, a sweat is, if you take a basketball and you cut it in half, and so you have a dome, and you enlarge that dome to it's about double my arm span, around like that, and you take willow branches, plant them in the ground, or push them in the ground, and then tie them at the top, and then you cover that dome with whatever. Now they use blankets and so forth, and then you dig a hole in the ground in the middle of that covered area, and you have a little entrance way to crawl in, and then you have a far outside, you build take hot rocks from the fire, you take them inside, and then you pour water on that, and then you sweat. Now, we used to do that up north, or we didn't participate in it, but they used to do that in Eagle, Alaska, but I didn't hear of any demonic thing. It was a way of washing their bodies and cleansing themselves. But in the Blackfoot Country, we have not heard of one of those sweats be something else but demonic. There's always something going on in there. And so the sweet grass is passed around, and then it's like a seance in our terminology here. And if you aren't in tune with the leader, little green men appear and kick your legs to make sure that you know that you're not in agreement with what's going on. And this is reality all the time. Many of our people are very fearful of these practices, but they're forced into them by their family sometime and so forth, and we hear about this all the time. But again, in there in that sweat, so they sweat and so they have sweet grass, but it does not change the heart. It's an empty ceremony. And then, and just read on now, in verse 12, it says, He said to me, Son of a man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness, each at the shrine of his own idol? Then say to the Lord, they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. And again he said, you will see them doing things even more detestable. And then the next picture is in verse 14. Then he brought me to the entrance of the north gate of the house of the Lord, and I saw women sitting there mourning for Tammuz. And he said to me, do you see this, son of man? You will see things that are even more detestable than this. Now, what in the world is Tammuz? Well, in the Medo-Babylonian god system, they had many, many, many gods. They had a god for everything. You name the subject, they had a god for it in their polytheism. And Tammuz was one of the minor gods. He was kind of like an agricultural god. We know something about him. His shrine or his idol would look like a shepherd. But this guy would come alive in the spring when the plants were being planted, or the wheat was being planted, fields were being tilled, and the seeds were sown. And there would be ceremonies for him at that point, but not this ceremony. And all through the growing season until harvest time. And then at harvest time, in that particular god system, Tammuz would die. And these women that are at the temple are performing a cry party or a ritual of crying and weeping for the death of Tammuz. Now, they're in the building that represents God's wanting a relationship with them, but they're worshiping this dead idol that comes alive in the spring and dies in the fall. Wouldn't you like to have a god like that? I don't know what you do during the wintertime, but I guess another god would take over or something in that in their thinking with all their gods. But that's what they were doing. They were there crying and crying because of the death of that god for an extended period of time. But right in that building was the answer to a personal relationship with a living God. Right there. And then how do you accomplish it? Simply coming by faith and acknowledging that it is there and that God placed it there. But these ladies had taken on this particular god system and were doing that. Well, when you think of the Blackfoot and some of the things that they do, one of the things that they do is Mother Earth is a huge issue to them. You hear very little about Father God because they are Gnostic in their thinking. And that means, to me, God is asleep up there somewhere and somebody else down here is taking care of things, in my simple terminology. And it's a system of a whole in a bunch of intermediate beings and so forth. And for the Blackfoot, the intermediate beings are a little bit different than the Greeks. They're all one pile and down here, and they don't have all those stair steps things that the Gnostic theory had, or worship system had in it. And they're worshiping the different spirits at times. And anyway, they worship Mother Earth, they talk about Mother Earth, and in their thinking, they are trying to align up their particular spirits that they worship and Mother Earth so that they'll be in agreement with Mother Earth. And it's a mystical concept that I've yet to figure out how it works practically. You know, our gospel works itself out practically, but this doesn't. Anyway, in our fellowship, the lady that is now faithful in attending after our church broke up here a few years ago and because of family problems and so forth that were outside of the body of the fellowship, Roxanne. Yeah, Roxanne Davis is this lady's name. She's a policeman by trade has had a number of years of service in the different police services in the area, including the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. At the moment, she's not employed there, but that's been her record. woman that knows how to think, how to work things through, and so forth and so on. But when she began to first attend our fellowship, her sister invited her, who was a truly born-again Christian, and that sister was witnessing to her. So Roxanne came to check us out, and during those years, she would come, and I would always hand out some notes, or always do when I can, and she would take those notes and really religiously write down what I was saying and copying it down, and she'd go home and look it over. But on the way home, Roxanne would take her daughter, grown daughter, down to the river where there are these big cottonwood trees, beautiful place. And they had a special spot down there every Sunday where they offered to their spirit world items like tobacco and money, and then she'd go home. So she would attend our church, and then she'd go to honor Mother Earth to make sure she was in alignment with Mother Earth, that she would be blessed by Mother Earth. And when you're traveling in Blackfoot country and you get up into the mountains, you will see kind of like, because the trees are pretty big, like strips of sheets torn, different colors, and they're tied around the trees. That's all part of this Mother Earth thing that they worship. And this is a big issue to them. But the end result is interesting. In the tabernacle, when you brought a sacrifice, by faith, it restored our broken relationship with God. God didn't change. But in the native mind, when you align yourself with all of those spirits, what you are doing is you're trying to appease that particular spirit or spirits to get your way, to manipulate them to accomplish your way. You see, it's just a flip of what the Bible teaches. And that's what we're dealing with. Our Blackfoot people have their way, and their way is to produce a life of whatever words they would want to fill in. Our Blackfoot people probably wouldn't use the word peace. I don't know what they'd put in there because they're quite a militant people. But anyway, their way. And that's the way they're looking at life. So here, these ladies in the time of Ezekiel were worshiping Tammuz, and right in their midst was the answer to someone who really would care for them and take care of the harvest in his will and his way to produce his glory in the people and for their benefit. And then the third thing, as we look here, and these women are worshiping, now we move on. He then brought me into the inner court of the house of the Lord, and there at the entrance to the temple between the portico and the altar were about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Lord and their faces towards the east. They were bowing down to the sun in the east. And so here another picture. We're still in the temple area, and you got 25 men this time. They've got their backs to God's house and their faces towards the east, and they're bowing down to the sun as it comes up. Wherever you touch this earth, you will find someone who is worshiping the creation rather than the creator. And we know that when we go back to the Ten Commandments and we see what God tells us there not to do that. That's the first thing that happens. And so that's what was happening here. The gods are not named or whatever. It just talks about the sun. And there are many, many different versions of that you can read and are brought to play in the Old Testament in your Bible when these words are mentioned. And if you're like me, you got to dig in there and find out what you're about. And then in the sense of how you witness and you recognize these things in other people. But anyway, they were worshiping the sun. The Blackfoot are part of the Plains Indians. And for those of you that are like me, to like the old cowboy westerns, and with the Indians, where the Indians always lose, and the guy in a white hat wins, and the black guy in a black hat gets shot and all that, they would show stuff like this, and it would be called the Sundance. In our way, it's something that's being revived. And we've been roughly in Alberta about 24 years, and this particular practice is 10 times stronger now among the Blackfoot, our friends, than it was 24 years ago when we came. How do I know that? They have a ceremony that's over a week long, once a year, and you count the teepees. When we first came, there was maybe a dozen teepees at the sacred grounds where this takes place. And today, you'll find way over 100. And you go to another site down in Montana in the Browning area, east of the Browning, there's a big flat plain, and that's their ceremonial grounds. And the same thing is taking place there today. This ceremony is complicated. It has many parts to it. I'll just illustrate the most popular part. And that is, they go and they cut a sacred tree. And the ceremony for that sacred tree cutting would take me a good 5 to 10 minutes to tell you about how the tree is selected. It has to be forked at the top, and how many chops they make a certain way and another way, and how many steps they take left or right to make sure that tree falls. And if that tree falls a certain way, it's either going to be a good ceremony or a poor ceremony, or they'll be cursed or whatever. But finally, they get that tree down, and then they have a ceremonial way of carrying that tree, and it's a big tree and a long tree, and they take that to the ceremonial ground. And then they plant that in the earth, and then as they are planting it in the earth, they tie ropes to the forks. And then they take, those ropes come down to the ground, and then the warriors, the young men, come, and they are now going to perform a ceremony to thank their guardian spirit for saving them during the year. This is the purity of this ceremony. The guardian spirit would have been acquired when they were a young boy and instructed by their elders to go out into the bush where the grizzly's running and they don't have any guns or anything, and moose and all that kind of stuff, and they would have to be there, and a lot of times they had to capture an eagle and so forth barehanded and all of this. And during this ceremony, and it was drug-induced in many places, these young men would have a vision. And this vision would give to them a guardian spirit. Now, that guardian spirit could be a chipmunk. It could be a black bear, but it would be an animal. Animism we're talking about here in the sense of a name for the religious practice. And that guardian spirit then, they would pray to and offer their sacrifices according to the vision they get. And they get a medicine bag, a leather bag that they put all these little things in there, like a squirrel's tail, somebody's scalp years ago, and whatever, a stick, whatever that became sacred to them, and in a sense, you could say, became their individual religion. And now another brave would do the same thing, and his practices and this guy's practices could be totally contradictory, but each were right in their way. And they have an individual right than to honor their practices. And the stories go on. But what they would do, they would now come to the annual ceremony, and if they had been delivered from a grizzly bear or from the enemy or whatever, then they would cut holes in their chest and stick little sticks through, pretty heavy sticks, and then tie that rope coming down from the pole, and then they would dance. And then they jerk back, and they dance, and they jerk back, and they dance, and they jerk back. And they do this until their flesh tears. And there's pictures of them where their flesh is extended way out, you know, and stretches. But it's in that way they are saying to their guardian spirit, I appreciate you. The tabernacle way, you come by faith. And you appreciate God by faith, listening to his directions about your particular sin or offense. And by faith, you bring that sacrifice and give it to him. And you go away in peace. Anyway, that's being practiced every July in the blood tribe that we work with. And it's growing, like I say, by gangbusters. And so as we think of some of these things and we look at life even here, we wonder sometimes about what is in the future. And I just want to look at verse 17 and 18 and see what Ezekiel says about people who practice these type of things. He said to me, "Have you seen this, son of man? It is a trivial matter for the house of Judah to do the detestable things they are doing. Must they also fill the land with violence and continually provoke me to anger. And we wonder in our culture today, even down here, the news, since we've been down here, my brother-in-law has a ritual at night and we watch the news, and the first thing is the most glamorous shooting in Washington, D.C. Every day has got to be at least one. But anyway, as we look at cultures and we look at history, when people turn their back upon the principles of this word and living by faith before the Lord, they turn to practices that will produce an empty, aggravated, miserable heart attitude, and they will turn to violence. And unless this country turns from that in some measure, it will continually increase. The only salvation to a nonviolent culture is that relationship with the true Creator. And that's it. And I want to just challenge you just for a moment. And I walk in your shoes in the sense of my family, extended family, and these things. In our society today, in the evangelical churches, and my supporting pastors have talked to me about this and come to me personally and talk to me about it. And that is, our believers are coming and doing lip service on Sunday morning to God. And when they leave the services, then they go and they serve the family concepts and marriage concepts that Hollywood produces. Why do we have the destruction of the family happening in evangelical churches? That's why. And it is high time that we be called, like Ezekiel is calling the people here, to get back to the by faith way of honoring a true and living God who wants a personal, endearing relationship with each of us in order to guide us through our life to give us peaceful, happy, and secure marriages. Many evangelical young people are dying like flies spiritually because they have come and they may even be an officer in the church, but when they leave, they serve in that part of the world out there. And they couldn't glue a marriage together. And that's the challenge that I just like to leave with you, that you here, whatever your age is, you have influence in your family. Use it for God's glory, to challenge your family to stay true to God. And then a prayer request for us. And that's in chapter that was being read this morning. And in the middle of that chapter, chapter 2, in verse 5, it says, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, in part of 4 there, and whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them. And that's the prayer that we would like for you to pray, along with other specific things we mentioned, for us. That whether the Blackfoot listen or they don't listen, that's not an issue to us. That's God's issue. The issue is whether we will be faithful to be recognized as a prophet. And I ask for your prayer for that, that we would be faithful, that they would know 15, 20 years ago, there had been a prophet that walked among them. Thank you.